Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Welcome along. Thank you for all of your messages about yesterday's episode, actually, about Read All About. It's really interesting talking about political magazines. Right, coming up on today's episode, Boris Johnson heading to Washington to meet Joe Biden. He's going on the train. Apparently they're going to bond over a love of trains, which was a good excuse to basically spend all day listening to Love Train. So in our big thing on the podcast today, we are going to get some tips on how do you woo a president from a former British ambassador to Washington, Sir Kim Darroch. Will Marshall, a former advisor to Bill Clinton, gives us the American side of the story too. So that's coming up in just a moment. But first, it's Tuesday, so it must be time for this.
Meet the Cerberus of columnists, the Janus of journalism, and the ultimate political portmanteau of opinion. Finkelvich with Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich on Times Radio.
Never not silly. Never not silly, that. Yes, it's that time of the week where we get to speak to Daniel Finkelstein. He's here in the studio. Morning, Danny.
Good morning.
And David Aronovich, who's beaming in from space. Morning, David.
Good morning. Yes, did you know that we are Emma Raducanu's and Dr. Sarah Gilbert's favourite section of any radio programme?
Have you made that up?
No, it's a complete lie, but Boris Johnson is going to Washington today, so I thought I'd kind of get in there first.
Well, we'll take it. We'll clip that out. We'll just take out the first bit, put it on social media. And I look forward to that rigging endorsement. Actually, when I was in Chorley at the weekend, people did say they liked Finkelvich. So there we are.
Did they?
Yeah.
Did they?
Yeah.
You know what they say in Aronovich? and if you travel from Aronovich to Finkelstein by train, they all love us.
They talk everyone else. They talk
all the passengers.
From Aronovich to Finkelstein on a train is definitely at least 48 hours in a closed carriage in freezing snow.
Yeah, but look what happens when you open it.
Yeah, at least, as long as you've got your Times Radio app along the way, you'll be absolutely fine. Well, let's talk about Boris Johnson then going to Washington. What do you... are we getting overexcited about this, David?
Well, what I was interested in, and again, as ever, I want to provoke Danny into some of his recollections because I really enjoy them, and reflections. But what I was thinking about when Boris Johnson said our relationships with America are better than they have ever been, blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff, I was wondering, who is that for? When we do this kind of big kind of boost about our relationships with the US president and so on, make these great big announcements, the US president knows what our relationships with America are, and we and the British government knows. So what is all this stuff for? And that's why I wanted to ask Danny, Who is this aimed at convincing, all this kind of ridiculous over-the-top hype that we get every single time? Is it for the, Daily Mail? Is it for the Time? Who's it for?
Well, look, it is partly a political point. At the moment, in particular, with the government having based its policy on leaving the European Union, it needs to be able to say it has a strong relationship with the United States, on which our security relationships all depend. And it can't say that if it... finding it difficult to say that after Donald Trump has left and Joe Biden's arrived. So there is a political point to be made, but it's also probably written into their diplomatic briefs. I know that the United States presidents are told they have to use certain kind of language about special relationships or the British will be annoyed. And so it's a, you know, it's one of those things where both sides are trying to fulfill the expectation of the others in diplomatic language that may no longer be very up to date.
And when Boris Johnson says it's the best relationship for, was it decades, he said? I was sort of thinking, I mean, clearly, Theresa, his immediate predecessors, Theresa May and Donald Trump, apart from holding hands, did not get on hugely well. Yes. But there were periods where David Cameron and Barack Obama got on pretty well. Yeah. I mean, if you go a bit further back, Tony Blair and George Bush famously got on possibly rather too well.
My attempt to get Theresa to open up about a meeting with Donald Trump will not count as one of the highlights of my conversational success. Let's put it that way.
You could have probably ended with your attempts to get Theresa May to open up.
He did indeed catch hold of her hand because he doesn't like going down steps.
Yes.
And that was indeed the reason. I mean, she did tell me that much, at least. And there were rarely a greater mismatch than between the temperament of Theresa May and that of Donald Trump. It wasn't surprising that that didn't work. But it was much more tricky with Boris Johnson and Donald Trump because in one way, we were reliant on the relationship with the United States after Brexit. And he knows that Donald Trump both saw Boris Johnson as a potential ally and is incredibly touchy about any criticism. And yet himself, as he's expressed in the past, thinks that Donald Trump's an idiot, and he said that, you know, often before. So it was quite a delicate task, actually, the relationship. And the relationship with Joe Biden is, although on the surface it looks more difficult, is in fact easier.
And in terms of what's on the agenda for them, David, it does feel like there's a whole... You could range whether, you know, it's still sorting out Afghanistan, the response to coronavirus, China... Russia. I mean, Russia today, there's been another reminder in the news Alexander Litvinenko and the European Court of Human Rights has found that Russia was responsible for the killing of Alexander Litvinenko. Are Britain and America still allies on all this stuff in the way that perhaps they were in the past, whether it was Thatcher and Reagan or Blair and Bush?
Well, this is always a very good question. So when we had the AUKUS submarine deal and so on, which caused some trouble, obviously, in France, with the French feeling very much that they, I think they are saying that they were lied to, actually, as far as I can kind of interpret. I have no idea whether that's true or not, but that's certainly what they're saying. We got a big shock over Afghanistan, which was strange in a way, because we were told right the way back in April that this is what Biden was going to do. And I think we all kind of believe, and we discussed this before, you, me and Danny, I think they believe that the Americans somehow knew something that they didn't about how it was likely to proceed. And then it was catastrophic. And the danger has always been, and the perception has always been, that America would turn away, as it had done in the period leading up to 1940, for example, from European interests and from, being the champion of democracy, to being very looking very internally, or at least very regionally. At that point, it was Latin America and so on. And now it's the Pacific. And bizarrely, really, Britain is trying to pose itself now as a kind of Pacific nation, now that it's out of the EU. Well, it is a kind of bizarre thing, you know. So we're now kind of incredibly concerned at taking on China with Australia and America, despite the fact we are nowhere near the South China Sea. I mean, really a long way away from the South China Sea.
I think it might be a legacy of Dominic Raab's grasp of geography, possibly.
One of the things, David, you asked me for sort of recollections about it, and one of the people that prime ministers are trying to impress when they talk about the United States and special relationship is themselves. There's no question that going to the United States appeals to the kind of West Wing fan in all of them. And I do know David Cameron said to me that when he appeared in the Rose Garden giving that speech from the podium was one of the few moments when he looked out on himself as being as Prime Minister and thought, my goodness, how did I get to being standing here? And I think visits to the United States do bring that out simply because of the amount of sort of cultural output that surrounds the White House and the presidency.
Yeah, and the grandiloquence of it. I mean, you visited the White House. I did once, or interviewed George Bush back in 2007. And the whole kind of business of it is incredibly, I wouldn't say quite intimidating, but it is imposing. And unless you're very careful, I mean, it's the obverse of what you're saying about David Cameron. You can get kind of quite carried away with this stuff. and think that it always must necessarily correspond to a complete capacity to order the world, whereas actually there are limitations there.
And I suppose, but at a time when global Britain is Boris Johnson's sort of big thing and trying to reassure his own MPs that Britain is still a thing, it's almost, you know, the yacht and all that and the trade deals, but the... actually rubbing shoulders as an equal with the actual president of the United States in the actual White House that's all part of the sort of rebuilding the brand of Britain post-Brexit.
Look, and there's no question that the partnerships between presidents and prime ministers have often been quite strategically significant in the history of our independent nuclear deterrent, the relationship between Macmillan and Kennedy, the relationship between Thatcher and Reagan, and between Blair and Bush, obviously. And it's interesting that the examples I've cited, they're not the same party, the same grouping, or the same, end of the political spectrum. And it may be that Boris Johnson, as I said, finds a relationship with Joe Biden, whom he doesn't think mad, although Joe Biden might not think him a political titan, is easier than the relationship he had with Donald Trump.
I touched on trade a bit there. And David, you've been sort of rootling around in the old tweets of the new International Trade Secretary, Anne-Marie Trevelyan.
Actually, I've not been rootling around in them. What's happened is that she, as Trade Secretary...
They have been rootled.
They have been a tiny bit rootled. And that, in a way, that's what I want to kind of come to, what kind of constitutes this. Back in 2010 and 2012, Anne-Marie Trevelyan, MP for Berwick, was sending out a whole lot of tweets saying that climate change didn't exist, wasn't happening, was a load of rubbish, and the people who said it was were deluded. Okay, spool on a little bit. And now this spring, she's going around saying all these terrible weather events are all a result of climate change. Got to do something about it. You know, get your fingers out, etc. So not unsurprisingly, somebody just kind of measured up the two and said, yeah, but back in 2012, this is what you were saying. Anyway, her response to it was this. You can, if you like, she said, go around excavating 20-year-old tweets, which are 20-year-old articles and tweets, which are... not exactly helpful to the climate cause, etc. But when the facts change, I change my mind. That's essentially what she said. And every bit of that was nonsense. I mean, it was just kind of absolute nonsense. It wasn't 20 years ago. It was 9 years ago. You didn't have to be Basil Brown or Sutton Hoo to stick in the Google Anne-Marie Trevelyan and climate change. That was kind of pretty easy. You know, it's not going to, you know, it's not a 10-year assault on a piece of ground in the East Midlands that you need to do that. But finally, it was just the chutzpah of saying, when the facts change, I change my mind. When the whole point is the facts haven't changed. You've changed your mind because you were totally wrong. And now you've got to convince people like the Australians that they're totally wrong now. And the best way of doing it, frankly, is to say, I got it wrong before. But no, politicians just can't do that. And it's one of the things I also wanted to take up with Danny. What is the problem with going back and say, you know, that thing I said in the past was a load of nonsense, etc. I was misguided. I was taken by the wrong kind of people. I didn't properly look at the evidence. I'm sorry, but this is what I think now.
I completely agree with what you've said. The reason why people don't do that is because what psychologists call consistency and commitment. People don't like people changing their mind weirdly, even though they like the fact that they've reached a new position that they prefer. They don't like inconsistency. And so other people try to pretend that they haven't been inconsistent and try to square off what they're saying now with what they said before, which you clearly can't. It's very interesting to me. I mean, obviously, what you say about the past is very interesting. It's also very interesting that she's taking that position now, that the orthodoxy in that part of the right has changed sufficiently that she can't maintain a position that, 10 years ago, people were quite tempted by, and that it now doesn't go along with her politics. It's not where the Prime Minister is, for example. Yeah. I'm really interested by that. I think it represents a real step forward, a triumph in the argument, a bit like, I saw happen in the Tory party on gay rights, a sudden shift where what had previously been unthinkable, unsayable, suddenly became the political consensus and a much better one. So I completely agree with what you've said so far, but I think there's an additional point, which is we should also welcome the position that she's taken now. I noticed that she's made this change of mind. I've got absolutely no interest in pursuing her on this because what matters is that she's right now. No, I'm serious. I don't disagree with anything you've said, but the important thing is not, I don't want to increase the price of two politicians of shifting from the psychological price and the political price of shifting from stupid positions to positions I regard as better ones. I want them to make that as cheap as possible. So, frankly, I shrug my shoulders at her not particularly convincing move from one to the other, but there's a reason why you chose that as an item rather than me.
But what I was struck by is that looking at the Guardian write-up of this story about Anne-Marie Trevelyan, because the old tweets, one of them said, "We aren't getting hotter, global warming isn't actually happening," that was to do with a campaign against wind farms. Another said, "Clear evidence the ice caps aren't melting after all to counter those doom mongers and global warming finance." So there's no doubt in the content. The Guardian wrote them up on the basis of the Labour Party digging them out. At no point did it mention in this Guardian story, I don't think, that in between those tweets and her becoming the International Trade Secretary, she's been Deputy COP26 Minister.
Yeah.
She's been so. And I've had conversations with Anne-Marie Trevelyan. She is quite clear. This isn't a sort of cynical political move. She has clearly changed her mind, and she is completely committed to the climate change.
Yeah, David's right to be annoyed. I mean, it is an annoying feature of human beings.
But just say, and in a way, it's a slightly more compelling political argument, isn't it? If she actually said, got it wrong.
We all pretend we want people to apologise and say we get it wrong. The reason we push people to do that is to humiliate them, not because we actually want them to do it. We think in ourselves we really want them to say that. But actually, we want them to say that. The Guardian wanted to say that in order to make Anne-Marie Trevelyan look silly, which she was, by the way. And she wants to resist it because she'd be accepting that she was silly, which she doesn't want to do.
Well,
right? I'm more concerned about is she right now? We don't actually... We pretend that we want people to come clean, and I think actually she'd spend the rest of her time apologising for her mistakes the moment she acknowledged them. So no, I can see why she doesn't do it. But you're not wrong, David.
No. Well, and you're not wrong either. So this is really awful conversation. So you're not wrong either. We're not
being the Cerberus of columnists, David. I don't think
gospel according to Matthew, which is that you welcome the sheep back into the fold more than the 90 who are already there, etc. Although the 90 already there get a bit pissed off about it because welcoming that sheep back.
David, you've sworn in this item, and the last
that's not swearing. That's not swearing.
The last
that's
time not swearing. The last time you did it, I tipped you off, and you said there's no children listening. And I saw my nieces a couple of weeks ago, and they said we were listening. Daddy was listening to the radio,
and David Aronovich said,
and the man swore. The man swore.
They did. They said the word, didn't they?
Come so what you need to do now, David, is what you need to do now, David, is apologise for the mistake that you made last time.
You need to admit you were wrong in the past in what you said, David.
I admit that Times Radio has a rule which I seem to have transgressed.
That's exactly what Anne-Marie Trevelyan would have said.
You are the Anne-Marie Trevelyan of Times
Absolutely.
Radio.
Absolutely. Knowing fully well that your nieces use that expression all the time.
No, they don't. They're like 8, 9 and 10.
Oh, come on. Come on, Matt. What are you on?
See, there you go.
Yeah, anyway, you know your niece is better. You know your niece is better. Anyway, the point I was going to make is about the reason why I differ very slightly is because persuasion has to be made on polities which hold the kind of position that Trevelyan did hold 10 years ago.
Yes, exactly.
Right now. I'm talking about the Australian government.
Her conversion might actually have some value in that case rather than it being a solid issue.
Exactly. Yeah. I think you were right to say that.
Danny Finkelstein and David Aronovich Day. Of course, you can read them in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. And right now, you get your first month for free. Coming up, what Boris Johnson should do as he heads to Washington.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now we're crossing the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's all about the love train. We're talking Boris Johnson and Joe Biden meeting in Washington later, asking what gifts should they exchange. Tom says a homemade double-decker bus Boris Johnson should give to Joe Biden. Somebody else pointed out, actually, that Boris now claiming he loves trains when we all thought previously he loved buses. Colin says, you mean Boris Johnson is betraying his first love, buses? How very uncharacteristic of him. Mark says, any train of thought from those two is bound to have a replacement bus service on. Big fan of that. Thank you very much. And Johnny says, a signed DVD of Derek Thomas, the tank engine. Derek Thomas is a Conservative MP. That is possibly too niche, even for me, Johnny. Anyway, keep those coming in. 8722, start your message of the word Times. You can tweet me at Times Radio. What should they exchange when they meet later on? And now we're going to slightly park the Motown music. And we're going to go in depth. Yes, we cross the Atlantic to discuss this meeting between Boris Johnson and Joe Biden at the White House, expected around, I think, about 9 o'clock UK time today. Now, the special relationship may have come under strain recently, not least with the approach to Afghanistan. But don't worry, Boris Johnson has told reporters travelling with him that he and Joe Biden have plenty in common. There we are. Yes, they're big fans of trains, as Joe Biden has memorably demonstrated.
I literally every single day that I was in the United States Senate, got either the 728, it became the 732, and got home on. If I got lucky, I got the Metro that left, the last one left at 6, or I got the 730 coming home.
Oh, is he finished? He's finished. What a fascinating. There's nothing more interesting than somebody describing their commute, Joe. But then Boris Johnson, he is right. He's a big fan of trains, as he demonstrated when trying out driving a tube train simulator.
All aboard. Mind the gap. Mind the gap. Stand clear of the gates. Here we go. It's a braking.
It's the braking thing that he has trouble with. Yes. So will their shared love of the choo-choo trains begin a new chapter for UK-US relations? But Boris Johnson seems to have conceded already that a trade deal is a long way off. You might say that Britain's at the back of the queue, but we don't say that anymore. Joe Biden is instead putting the US's commitment to fighting climate change at the top of the agenda for their talks today. There's also obviously the news that broke overnight that the US is going to open up to foreign travellers. It's a bit of a shock announcement, that one. In a moment, I'm going to speak to Sir Kim Dowick, who was the British ambassador to the United States, famously when Donald Trump was in office. But first, Sarah Baxter from the Sunday Times tells us what to expect.
It wasn't that long ago that Boris Johnson was hailed as Britain Trump by the President of the United States. But that guy is checked out of the White House, for the time being at any rate. AUKUS, you might say. Or should that be AUKUS? The new Indo-Pacific strategic alliance between Australia, the US and Britain has shown there is a wisp of breath left in the old special relationship. The flexible Johnson took a decision early on to curry favour with Joe Biden and lavished attention on him at the G7 summit in Cornwall. And Biden? Well, he's old enough to regard Britain as America's best ally. And according to Boris, they also have one big thing in common. They're both train nuts. As world leaders mill around New York for the UN General Assembly, Biden has paid Johnson the compliment of inviting him to the White House. Ahead of their meeting, he's lifting the one-sided ban on vaccinated British travellers entering America. An offer he's also extended to all EU countries, but let's not dwell on that. And Biden also appears willing to reach into his pockets for a few billion dollars to spend on reducing carbon emissions. Welcome news for Boris ahead of the Glasgow summit on climate change. Disagreements over the pullout from Afghanistan, rows about the Northern Irish Protocol, the frustrating lack of a trade deal between the US and post-Brexit Britain. These things will be raised and smoothed over. There has been a lot of sherpering by diplomats in advance of the meeting to make sure the two men appear best pals. I can vividly recall Bill Clinton's sense of bewilderment and pique when Tony Blair dropped him like a hotcake once he was out of office and began making eyes at the Republican, George W. Bush. Well, Boris is no different. It's Trump who and hello, Joe. And if Trump were ever to come back, well, that's a problem for another day.
Sarah Baxter there from the Sunday Times giving us her take on the meeting between Joe Biden and Boris Johnson later. Well, how does a British Prime Minister prepare for a meeting in the Oval Office? Let's speak to Kim Dowick, Lord Dowick, who was the British ambassador to the United States between 2016 and 2019, and joins me now. Good morning, Kim.
Morning. How are you?
I'm very good. Let's talk sort of in general terms, first of all, but we'll talk about the specific issue that you had with a British Prime Minister going to the Oval Office. How significant is this? The Boris Johnson is in New York anyway for the UN General Assembly, but he's got the invite to the White House. Are we reading too much into that?
I think that a little too much is being read into it, but they didn't have to meet in the White House. They could have met at in New York, whether at one of the consulates or in a hotel somewhere. So it's significant that Biden has invited him to the White House. Theresa May got in a week after inauguration, back in 2017. This is 8 months or so into Biden's presidency, but it's a welcome invite, and it should be taken as an indication that although there are ideological differences, this isn't Thatcher and Reagan or Blair and Clinton, they come from different sides of the political spectrum, but this US administration wants a strong relationship with the UK.
And let's talk about what the sort of the process of all this. What is Boris Johnson told? What's the sort of the diplomatic service doing to prepare him for this meeting? And the involvement of the British ambassador in that?
Yeah. What you will have is quite a lot of talk across the normal channels, in part the embassy and the ambassador in Washington to the administration, mostly to the National Security Advisor sitting in the White House, and in part capital to capital, number 10 to the White House. Agreement on the management of the meeting, the choreography, the press conference, whether there's going to be a lunch or a dinner attached to it, who is going to be on each delegation so the numbers match up, but also, most importantly, the agenda for the meeting. And the meeting between Theresa May and Donald Trump, I mean, there was an agenda agreed, but they were very new in office and new in government. They didn't really stick to it, to be frank. I think it'll be much more structured with Biden and Johnson. They'll have agreed the order of what points they want to cover, the order in which they cover them, and they'll go through those points in the course of the meeting, trying to complete the whole thing in the allotted time.
OK, let's talk about your particular experience. You became the US ambassador at the beginning of 2016, which obviously all was well, quiet in the world at the beginning of 2016. We had the Brexit vote. Then Donald Trump became US president. You were the ambassador when Theresa May made her famous trip to the White House to meet Donald Trump. What was that like, trying to, you know, there's all this focus on the special relationship and trying to foster good relations. How do you go about approaching that with someone like Theresa May and Donald Trump, who couldn't be more diametrically opposed in almost every way, both personally, politically, their approach to almost everything?
Yeah, Matt, it became clear in the course of the next year or two that these two weren't really going to connect on a kind of personal level. But you didn't know that at the time. And the Trump team were very new into the White House. So we weren't able to prepare in the same kind of depth as I think Johnson and Biden will have done. And we, as I say, we sort of had an agenda, but it wasn't clear whether President Trump would stick to it. And what they arranged was a 15 to 20 minute, we call a tete-a-tete, which is just the two of them chatting, getting to know one another right at the beginning of the meeting. And then there was the plenary session where we officials came in and listened. And then there was a lunch after that. So the whole thing took, you know, 2.5 hours or so. I doubt that the Johnson-Biden meeting will be quite that long. And it was a week after they'd all got into the White House. So they knew their way around the building and were just finding their way on how to do this kind of thing. So it was different. This will be a very slick, well-organized, well-structured diplomatic summit between the two of them.
There's listeners will remember your dramatic departure from Washington after those diplomatic cables were released. Some of the messages you've been sending back to the British government, your assessment on the Trump administration is inept and insecure and so on, were leaked. Donald Trump got very cross about that, and then you resigned. Is there a sense that normality is returning to Washington, do you think?
I think so. But remember that the former president is still very much a political presence on the scene. It's not like one of these two-term presidents who then, maximum two terms allowed under the US system, who then retire to construct their presidential library. I mean, Donald Trump is hinting very actively that he might run again in 2024, which he's entitled to do. So I'm not sure it feels completely normal now. Plus, we're not in normal times, man. I mean, the pandemic, withdrawal from Afghanistan, the energy crisis, which I guess, you know, will be global. Prices have gone up for everyone, although the Americans have some of their own supplies. So these are crisis-ridden times, and so it doesn't feel like the tranquility of some of the encounters that have happened in the past.
What would be a diplomatic win for Boris Johnson coming out when he leaves the White House later today, do you think?
He is not going to get, I think, and this has been well telegraphed in advance, anything on trade deals. A number of us have been predicting for a while that there isn't going to be an early trade deal. I think they can talk about their joint commitment to vaccinate the world, which, if we want to really tackle the pandemic, is going to be essential. But if you're looking for a win, we're hosting COP26, the climate change summit, in November. That is crucial to delivering the kind of global effort that we need to tackle climate change. And no one can doubt anymore that climate change is a real crisis approaching down the line to us. And what's crucial for the success of that meeting that we are hosting is a big enough fund to help the developing world get its adapt for climate change, reduce its their CO2 emissions. Otherwise, the developing world can't afford to do that. And how much the Americans contribute to that fund is absolutely critical to the success or otherwise of the summit. So if you get some sort of promise undertaking from Joe Biden, I think he may keep his figure for his speech to the UN. So I'm not sure when the figure will come out. But if there is a promise of a significantly increased US contribution, then I think the Prime Minister can claim that as a win. There's something that might unlock the challenge of this summit.
Just fun. I don't know if you've read William Hague in the Times today. He's obviously former Foreign Secretary. He lays out some advice to Liz Truss, the new Foreign Secretary, and he says he wishes her well. And this is an advice, but I think he describes himself as an old timer. But he sort of goes through some of the ways that he seems to think that maybe the diplomatic service, the Foreign Office, isn't working quite right. You know, being caught off guard by what happened in Afghanistan. Trying to bring together the Foreign Office, international development, that's causing some problems too. Others have commented on the fact that Britain seems to be completely blindsided by the announcement on the lifting of the travel ban by the United States. Having been in and around the diplomatic service for a long time, what state is the Foreign Office and the British diplomatic service in right now? Is it functioning properly?
Look, it's facing big, big challenges. It's facing the whole change in our international posture that comes from Brexit. It's facing the challenge, which is a big one, of integrating what was DFID, International Development Department, into the Foreign Office. And it's facing the same difficulties as all institutions are in coping with the pandemic and in a time when there are challenges mounting all around the world. I think it's still full of extraordinarily talented people. I wish good luck to the new Foreign Secretary. But these are very difficult times. And if you're in the Foreign Office, if you don't anticipate everything perfectly, it's kind of all your fault. But I don't think anyone expected the Taliban to take control in Afghanistan quite as quickly as they did. I don't think there's any evidence that any intelligence service or any foreign ministry around the West anticipated that. As for the travel ban, I don't know whether we knew in advance, but sooner or later the US were going to lift the travel ban for their own interests as well as for ours, and it's very good news for us. And whether it was communicated in advance, I'm not sure, but timing it for the Johnson-Biden summit tells you that they wanted a positive signal about the relationship to come out just before that summit. So that timing was interesting and a positive move.
Just finally, given these things do matter, what would you, if you were still the ambassador, what would you recommend as an exchange of gifts between Boris Johnson and Joe Biden?
that's a tricky question to throw. I would just say of Joe Biden that he is a man with a deep sense of history, and he's been around a long, long time. And I think he's the kind of man to whom you should give something that has historical connotations and some sort of symbol of British-American relations and how it's developed, particularly over the last four decades. Joe Biden was a senator for a long, long time, and something that will symbolise the last two decades of UK-US relations and some of the things we've done together would be appropriate.
Well, we wait to see what's in the cargo hold, the hand luggage, isn't he? Because he's going on the train. Really good to speak to you, Kim Dowick, Lord Dowick, there, former British ambassador to the United States, now chairing Best for Britain as well, the campaign group. Let's now find out how these talks will be viewed from an American perspective. Will Marshall is a former advisor to Bill Clinton, and I asked him what advice he'd give to Boris Johnson when sitting down with the US president.
If I were in that position, I would say, do what you're doing now. I mean, Mr. Johnson is emphasizing climate change. He's here ahead of the COP26 meeting. And I think that would be an easy ground for affinities with President Biden, who's very much focused on methane control, on COP26, on climate change. So I think they would have no problem starting a constructive conversation on that score. You know, it might get more difficult when we're talking about trade, when we're talking about the impact of Brexit on Northern Ireland. So there are other topics that would be maybe a little more difficult. But, you know, I think that this relationship is there to be rebuilt. We have, you know, still by our lights, a new president who is quite different than his predecessor. So I think there's a grounds for maybe starting over, not only, you know, with Great Britain, but also with Europe. And clearly, in light of recent events, there's a need to, for this president to pay particular attention to mending fences there.
You mentioned that Joe Biden is very different to his predecessor, but there's a slight feeling taking hold, I think, in the UK that actually he might look very different to Donald Trump, but he might use very, you know, less colourful language. But in policy terms, he seems quite similar. He went ahead with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. There's a lot more he doesn't necessarily use the same America first rhetoric of Donald Trump, but there seems to be a sort of much more focus on domestic issues and not being the sort of the policeman of the world the previous presidents have done. Is that a fair characterization of Joe Biden, do you think?
Well, not entirely. Look, I understand there's confusion when Joe Biden talks about a foreign policy for the middle class, of course, in the United States. And some of his particular policies, Buy American at Home, and, you know, a very strong emphasis on rebuilding the prosperity of working and middle class Americans. That you keep in mind that that's his consuming preoccupation right now with the big legislative packages up before Congress. And clearly, you know, the White House has fallen down on the job of consultation with allies. The president went to Europe in June and said America is back. And by that, he meant America was back in its old relationship with its transatlantic allies. They wanted to build up the alliance, not tear it down like his predecessor, that he had confidence in it and his counterparts in Europe. And, you know, so there's confusion on that score, I grant you, because there was insufficient consultation around the precipitation of Joe Biden's exit from Afghanistan. That he wanted to get out was no surprise. He said that. He was not even in favor of the surge back when he was vice president under Barack Obama. So the policy goal was not a surprise, but the haste by which this administration pursued it and the lack of consultation were surprises. And I think they've got work to do at the White House to rebuild confidence. And, of course, that was now with the flap with France. That's also the case with this new AUKUS relationship and the submarine deal with Australia, where there was evidently very little consultation, although Secretary of State Tony Blinken says that he tried to reach the French foreign minister before to talk about it. But in any event, they didn't connect. And so it seems like another setback from the point of view of close communications with allies. So there's work to be done there, but I don't think that changes the substance of Joe Biden's outlook on the world. He is a known commodity. He's been in public life since the late 1960s in the United States, and people pretty much know that he's an internationalist and an Atlanticist. But he's also making adjustments that the American public is demanding about our commitments overseas, a more selective approach, and trying to, you know, cut losses, as he saw it in Afghanistan, where there just isn't any more appetite in the United States for continued military political engagement there.
And what about the sort of the language and the way that the successive British prime ministers have sought to maybe emulate the language of US presidents? I mean, at the moment, Boris Johnson's using Build Back Better, which I think Joe Biden used. Well, there's some debate over who used it first, but they both seem to be using it actually in the same way that in the past, you know, Bill Clinton had the New Democrats when, you know, Tony Blair had New Labour. You can even go right back to sort of Harold Wilson trying to emulate what JFK was saying. How important is that? Is it superficial, but actually this sort of sense of shared endeavour and shared language and vocabulary, does that matter to help it to build a common relationship?
It could. I mean, I think that, Joe Biden certainly thinks Build Back Better is his slogan, but that's okay. He will take support, from good friends like Great Britain on that score. And so, yeah, that is, he's when he was in Europe, the president, proposed a kind of global Build Back Better initiative to counter China's Belt and Road initiative. So the idea of a concerted effort by Western liberal democracies to counter rising Chinese influence in the world is something that Joe Biden is intensely interested in, and a topic that Prime Minister Johnson could find, a very fruitful one, I think, with this president.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not rate and review us wherever you get your podcast from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.